This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Conflict and uncertainty can make life difficult for minorities in the United States. As we've seen, events of the last decade have led some to be suspicious of American Muslims. Unfortunately, this is not new in our history. During the U.S. Civil War, it was Jewish Americans who came under suspicion. Adding to existing prejudices were broad accusations of trading with Confederates and undermining the Union. Things came to a head in December 1862 when U.S. Major General and future President Ulysses S. Grant issued General Order No. 11, expelling all Jews from areas under his command, including western Kentucky. But thanks largely to a Paducah shopkeeper, it was rescinded soon after. How the order came to be, how it was revoked, and how it strengthened both Grant's and the American Jewish community is the subject of a new book by Dr. Jonathan Sarna titled When General Grant Expelled the Jews. And Dr. Sarna joins us on the line from his office at Brandeis University. Dr. Sarna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
General Order No. 11 is one of the more compelling stories to come out of the U.S. Civil War, but comparatively few people know about it. How did you come across it?
Well, I think that for Jewish historians, it's something that's been known. And when I wrote the small section about the Civil War in my book, American Judaism, I was struck by the fact that the literature on the order was rather weak. And here was a moment when American Jewish history really came into contact with the larger history of the Civil War. It sounded like a story that deserved more attention. When I was a young scholar, I was invited to give a talk to the board of the institution where I was then teaching, and that was the anniversary of the order, the 120th anniversary, and new documents about the order had come into existence. And that was the first time I spoke about the order, and as I recount, it was quite memorable. I talked about the smuggling, and I then said we now knew that General Grant's own father had cooked up a scheme with the Mack brothers of Cincinnati to move southern cotton northward. And no sooner was my speech over than a man raised his hand and began saying, "My name is Mack." And he, of course, turned out to be the great-grandson of the Mack who had been involved in that order. After a rather long and dramatic pause, he said, "And it's all true." And at that point, everybody relaxed. And, of course, it was confirmation that the family had known the story, but had been embarrassed by it and kept it a secret. Later on, when I realized how little had been written and how in many ways the story of Grant and the Jews, which goes beyond the order, was a very inspiring story because Grant does a 180-degree turnaround, I thought it was worthy of a book. And this is the 150th anniversary of the order this December, so it made a great deal of sense to bring the book out now.
What is the substance of General Order No. 11?
General Order No. 11 reads that the Jews as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. Now, the department refers to the Department of the Tennessee, which is the area under Grant's command at the time. And it was a huge area, not just Tennessee. It stretched from northern Mississippi to Cairo, Illinois, and from the Mississippi River to the Tennessee River. So it was a big area.
Could you paint us a picture of what life in the United States was like for the American Jewish community in the 1860s?
Well, the Jewish community had been growing very quickly at that time. There were perhaps 3,000 Jews in America in 1820, 15,000 in 1840, 150,000 in 1860. So most of the Jews were newcomers, immigrants from Central Europe. Many of them were merchants of one kind or another. And because opportunity lay west, a lot of these Jews had indeed moved across the country, and some of them had moved in to the south, opening up stores that really brought goods to places that often had not had those goods. But many of them were easily marked by their foreign accents and foreign ways.
I want to bring this around to the one of the first people we meet in the book. You begin the book with the story of one Jewish businessman in Paducah, Caesar Kaskel. Why did you put him front and center?
I'm very impressed with Caesar Kaskel. The story is that eventually General Order No. 11 gets to Paducah. The order travels very slowly for the simple reason that Grant's forces had been attacked and all of the telegraph wires had been cut. And there are about 30 families there, and they are ordered out. Now, Caesar Kaskel was a staunch Union supporter. His brother actually recruited for the Union. He was involved with the Union Club. But, you know, the order didn't distinguish. It said Jews as a class. So he was ordered to leave. And he had the presence of mind not only to send a long telegram to Abraham Lincoln, but also to write up what we would call a press release and to distribute it to any reporter he met. And it was because of Kaskel that news of General Order No. 11 becomes known and gets into the newspapers. And then this man, like a kind of a Civil War era Paul Revere, gets down to Washington, spreading news of the order wherever he went. He goes to see a sympathetic congressman who gets him in to see Lincoln. Lincoln, of course, had knew nothing about the order. It never had reached Washington because the telegraph lines had been cut. And years later, there is this wonderful conversation with Lincoln that is recorded. This may have been embellished, but it's still wonderful, where Lincoln says, "Oh, and so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan." And Kaskel cleverly replies, "Yes, and that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." And Lincoln said, "Yes, and this protection they shall have at once." Lincoln indeed orders the general-in-chief of the army, Halleck, to countermand General Orders No. 11. Kaskel is really the hero who spreads the news, goes to Washington, makes possible the revocation of the order.
I'd just like to let our listeners know we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Sarna, author of the new book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews, on Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Well, your book goes on to discuss General and later President Grant's efforts to make up for the order. The idea of atonement is a very central one in Judaism. The holiest day in the Jewish calendar is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Were Grant's subsequent actions his way of atoning for General Order No. 11, and did his relationship with American Jews improve because they saw that and responded to it?
Yes, I think they did. And, you know, atonement has two parts to it. There's what you say, and there's what you do. So in 1868, Grant runs for president, and indeed this order becomes a quite central theme in the campaign, partly, I'm sure, to sway Jewish voters, but partly to spread doubt in the minds of all voters as to what kind of a person Grant was. And although Grant doesn't respond directly before the election, he does kind of indirectly after the election. He publishes a letter in which he writes, "I do not pretend to sustain that order. I have no prejudice against sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit." And that's really what Jews wanted to hear. And then, of course, the question was, well, what would Grant do when he was actually in the White House? And there is no question that as President Grant lived up to that notion of judging individuals by their own merit, and he's the first president to have had a Jewish advisor, and he appoints a series of Jews to public office, and we know that he tried to appoint a Jewish cabinet member who turned him down. That was Joseph Seligman for Secretary of the Treasury. But he does appoint a Jewish governor of Washington. He appoints a Jew for the first time to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And even more significantly, from my perspective, he really supports Jews when they are persecuted abroad. Now, I think, as Grant is being rediscovered by a new generation and his career is reexamined, and I think we have much more respect for what he tried to do during Reconstruction, it's interesting to look back at this chapter, seemingly a stain on his career, and to see that even here, in terms of the Jewish community, he repented and comes out looking very different than you would imagine if you read simply the Jewish Encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia Judaica, the new edition, which simply talks about his order expelling the Jews but doesn't recount any of the rest of the story.
What was General Grant thinking when he issued this order?
I think that Grant was deeply concerned about smuggling. He was a great believer in sieges, and he saw smuggling as truly undermining the Union cause. Now, we now know that all sorts of people were smuggling. There was a huge amount of money that could be made smuggling in both directions. But Grant blamed a widespread problem on a visible group. We often do that, even now. It's the essence of prejudice, but we do it. The widespread problem was smuggling, but Jews were visible. They looked different. They sounded a little different with their accents. And he became persuaded that all smugglers were Jews, whether they were Jewish or not. But so that was the larger cause. The occasion, as I said at the beginning, was when he found that his own father, with whom he had a very complicated relationship, Jesse Grant, had cooked up a scheme with the Mack brothers, a Jewish firm in Cincinnati, to move Southern cotton northward. And he saw, wow, his own father is being entrapped, as he saw it, by the Jews. So we have a couple of accounts that he blew up and expelled the Jews. In many ways, he expelled the Jews instead of expelling his father on that occasion. So the occasion was very much a familial dispute. How could my father, my own father, have wanted to take advantage of my position and move Southern cotton north with all that would mean for giving currency to the South and prolonging the war, as he saw it? So, you know, they believed that you can't simultaneously fight an enemy and trade with that enemy.
Why isn't the wider community more familiar with this story?
It certainly is a good question. Hard to know why certain episodes are not better known. I think perhaps because so few Jews were actually expelled, that is to say, the word of the order spread slowly, and it was revoked before I couldn't find even 100 Jews who were expelled. So, you know, it becomes one of these events in a larger war. And after all, the war is filled with horrors. And I suppose some felt, well, in comparison with what happened, and the thousands who gave their lives in some of these battles, this was a footnote. And the truth is that we know that there were other horrific episodes or denial of rights and so on in the Civil War. There were anti-Irish riots and obviously attacks on blacks and a good deal of anti-Catholicism. But we have generally not told the story of the war in that way. And, of course, Grant himself makes no mention of this episode in his wonderful memoirs. They're very justly celebrated, but Grant thought that the less said about General Orders Number 11, the better. He does not mention it in his memoirs.
Further on, you talk about how this whole episode really ended up, instead of disempowering the American Jewish community, it empowered it.
Yes. I think the fact that Jews realized that they could get the order overturned, they could protest. This wasn't like other expulsions. You know, Jews could protest when they were expelled from Spain, but it didn't have any impact. But here in America, they could fight back and win. And then, indeed, in Grant's administration, Jews succeed in politics in a way that they never had been able to before. And I think that that emboldens the community and gives them a sense that they can indeed be equals in this country. And that's always important for any minority group.
Dr. Jonathan Sarna is professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University. His new book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews, is now out and available at bookstores and online. Dr. Sarna, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Spring and spring planting is just around the corner, but crops aren't the only things Western Kentuckians are looking to cultivate. Area officials want to grow jobs as well. That story is coming up after the break on Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton.
He missed it. There's the horn. And the season ends as Marquette beats Murray State 62-53.
That's the Racer Network's Neil Bradley. The Racers walked off the court in disbelief last night after their historic season ended in the second round of the NCAA tournament. The Racers came into this year's tournament with the winning most senior class in Racer history, one Sporting News All-American, and Basketball Times Coach of the Year in Steve Prohm. Not to mention all the other accolades, including OVC regular season and tournament champions. The Racers led Marquette at the half, but the fast-paced game had 11 lead changes. The Racers went into the final 8 minutes with a 46-41 lead, and that was the last time they would be ahead. In the final 7 minutes, the Racers were 2-for-12. The Racer Network's Neil Bradley spoke with assistant coach Matt McMahon after the game. He says both teams had great defense, but he attributes the loss to the Racers' poor shooting performance.
You go 31% from the floor, 19 from three against a team like Marquette. It's really tough to overcome. It's really a credit to our defense that we were in the position to win the game.
The Racers' Isaiah Cannon, a Sporting News first-team All-American, led his team in scoring with 16 points, and junior Ed Daniel led in rebounds with 14. Big East Player of the Year Jay Crowder led Marquette in rebounding and scoring. Marquette moves on to play the winner of today's Florida-Norfolk State game. The Racers will come home and spend time off for spring break. Racer Athletics will announce a celebration for this year's team in the coming days.
March is a big month for college basketball, and with Kentucky teams making a splash in the NCAA tournament, fans in the Commonwealth have a lot to cheer about. Lexington is known for its diehard love of the Wildcats, and that devotion extends to businesses as well. Kentucky Public Radio's Brenna Angel reports on how some local businesses are showing and benefiting from their school spirit.
The barbershop near the corner of Euclid and Woodland Avenues in Lexington is like most barbershops, offering men's haircuts, beard trimming, straight razor shaves. But the atmosphere owner Ryan Likens has created is a lot like a sports bar.
Trim me around. Do you want it blocked in the back or do you want it tapered out?
Blocked.
Likens and his wife Cassandra own Kentucky Wild Cuts Barbershop, a business they opened about 3 years ago.
We thought about naming it just Wild Cuts, and we thought, well, if we can put the Kentucky in front, they won't think it's just crazy haircuts. They'll know it's a play off the university.
The Wild Cuts shop is decked out in University of Kentucky sports stuff. Posters, autographed balls, pictures of athletes, most of it given by loyal customers like Stuart Hines. He's a former offensive lineman for the UK football team.
You know, a lot of people come in here and it's cool because they have the memorabilia and stuff.
Located within walking distance of campus, Likens figured a lot of his customers would be students and alumni, and he was right. This semester, Wild Cuts Barbershop has been busier than ever.
I couldn't imagine naming it anything else. It just made sense.
Harrod Concrete and Stone is another local business with a mascot connection. President David Harrod is a season ticket holder and has the classic UK Wildcat logo painted on all of his cement trucks.
We are known for that. And it does differentiate us a little bit.
Harrod can remember going to Kentucky ball games as a boy with his father. He says using company vehicles to cheerlead for UK is a tradition that started decades ago.
The first ones I remember were back in the early 70s. Fran Kersey was the football coach, and the drums were painted like footballs. And the slogan said, "Our cats are fantastic."
Several Central Kentucky businesses have a Wildcat or Blue theme. There's Wildcat Ford, Wildcat Massage Therapy, Wildcat Dental Lab, and Bleed Blue Tattoo and Piercing, just to name a few.
So Wildcat is somewhat of a generic term. There's an obvious reason that people in this marketplace choose to use that name as part of their name.
Jason Schlaffer is a senior associate athletic director for UK. It's his job to make sure the university's trademarks and copyrights are protected and that companies don't violate the school's licensing program. Last year, Schlaffer says licensing of athletic names and logos generated about $4.5 million for UK.
There's a lot of goodwill associated with the university, and our brand is an extension of that. And if we allow folks to trade on our goodwill and our good name without our authorization, we have no control over that, and it has a chance to dilute and diminish the university's name.
Mascot-themed businesses are not unique to Lexington. You'll also find them in other big college towns like Lawrence, Kansas, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. For David Harrod, who, by the way, says he was granted a license to use the Wildcat logo on his trucks, it's not about attracting customers, but showing support.
It is a source of pride, and it's a source of pride that everybody in Lexington should have. And it's not just athletics, because there's a lot of good stuff going on in the UK.
And when it's game time, Harrod won't be cheering on the Cats as a business owner, but as a regular Bleed Blue fan. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Brenna Angel.
Lawmakers in Frankfort have been hard at work over the past week in the Kentucky General Assembly. A proposed statewide indoor smoking ban cleared its first legislative hurdle, and the Senate has passed four constitutional amendments. Rick Hallett spoke with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston on Friday to get the latest on what's happening in Frankfort.
So are the lawmakers back in session today?
They did come in session today. The House actually had a kind of busy day. They passed the three road plan bills, obviously the transportation budget, that cabinet's budget. They passed the two-year road plan, and they passed a joint resolution, which has the effect of law, but basically that's the what's called the six-year plan. It's the other 4 years, and it's kind of the wish list of everybody, kind of gives them a blueprint for 2 years from now what they want to do again. So the House passed all three of those bills and promptly sent them to the Senate and passed a few other small changes as well.
Let's talk about some of the business that has been conducted. You mentioned the budget. Where does it stand now?
Well, the Senate has the budget in their hands. They've had it for about a week. They've had a lot of meetings, a few committee meetings, but nothing really publicly. I expect the Senate to pop out their changes to the budget this upcoming week. I don't know exactly what day. There's some confusion on how quickly the Senate will cobble together all those proposals, but it could be early this week. Senate leadership is meeting over the weekend to hammer out the final details of the budget, so I would expect the Senate to come out this week. We already know there will be changes. The question is, are there changes that the House can go with, or are they talking about monumental changes? And I would be surprised if they're monumental changes, because neither side is really acting like they're going to go into a special session, that they're going to have to stop the clocks or not be able to get this budget out on time. So I think you'll see the budget pop out of the Senate, you know, obviously this coming up week. You could have conference committee set up by Thursday or Friday, and they could work over the weekend, obviously basketball allowing. But, you know, going into that last week, could have conference could come together, and they actually pass a budget out on time that they don't have to worry about vetoes from the governor with, because they'll have time to override those vetoes.
And a couple of drug-related measures. Where do we stand on the pseudoephedrine regulation bill?
The pseudo bill will probably come up for a committee vote on Monday. The House Judiciary Committee has a special meeting planned. Obviously, that agenda has not been posted yet. That's what happened this week when the Senate Bill 2 came up. You know, it was kind of last minute, but they have it for upon adjournment on Monday, so that would be late Monday evening. We're talking 5, 6 o'clock. My expectation is with the changes that bill probably passes. House Speaker Greg Stumbo supports the bill. That's obviously a big hurdle you have to clear anytime you have a bill in the House. And I think there will be some floor amendments that take away some of the restrictions, make it a little bit more relaxed, but I don't know that those amendments will pass. I think the bill that we saw come out of the Senate will basically pass the House. When it comes to the synthetic drug bill, I believe that'll pass the Senate. I don't see a lot of changes there. And really, the only other thing drug-related that we're looking at is House Bill 4, whether the Kentucky Medical Association and their lobbying efforts weakens that bill in the Senate or not.
Now, would the pseudoephedrine bill still require a prescription?
No. What the compromise on this PSE bill does is that it allows anybody over-the-counter to get 7.2 grams of pseudoephedrine-containing medicine a month. You know, your Sudafed, your Mucinex, that's roughly two boxes. After that, you can go to a doctor. If you need more than that, let's say you have asthma or allergies, you can go to a doctor, and a doctor can prescribe 7.5 grams a month. And so basically, you know, what they're saying is that basically you can have, you know, four boxes at a time, you know, before, and it's a 24-gram annual limit. So basically they say, you know, for the average person, this will give you four or five boxes a year. You know, this will take care of two boxes in the springtime, two boxes in the fall where everybody gets their stuffy nose. And then if you, you know, have a long-term, if you're taking it for maintenance, for symptoms related to asthma or allergies, the doctor's prescription will allow you to take the lower dosage pills all year long without, you know, you'd have to see a doctor, but it would allow you to get those prescriptions all year long.
And you mentioned synthetic drug crackdown. Are we talking about the so-called bath salts and that sort of thing?
That's exactly what we're talking about. And the legislature has passed one of these bills every session, and what they're doing now is that they're basically saying, listen, you all change these chemical compounds and these names faster than we meet every year, so we're going to take a look at that. We're going to attack the compounds. That's what we're going to do. If you change this drug, or if you simulate this effect of, you know, let's say marijuana or cocaine or something like that, it is still the same offense. You know, we're not attacking individual drugs now. We are going after the chemical compounds, and then that way it doesn't matter how you change it chemically or if you change its name. If we catch you, you're in trouble.
Sounds like some really nasty stuff, that the bath salts. There's really been a lot of horror stories coming out of, you know, the abuse of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane. The Representative John Tilley, who has shown videos of just it looks like 18-year-old kids who are just out of their mind. I mean, just laughing hysterically one minute and then having the most confused look, scared look on their faces. I mean, the testimony and everything else on this, it's been wild. It is quite crazy. And in some cases, apparently, you can just walk into your neighborhood convenience store and buy these things. So that's what lawmakers want to do. They want to take that out. They're going after some of these convenience stores who sell these things, and they're really saying, you know what, we're tired of these little fixes. We're going all in on ending this problem.
On another topic, there's been a lot of wrangling over the possible addition of the University of Pikeville to the state university system. Where does that stand?
Well, that bill has been changed to more of a scholarship program for those in eastern Kentucky that college juniors or seniors who probably have gone through 2 years of community college can go to UPI, go to the University of the Cumberland, any of those private colleges or any of the public partnerships that Morehead or Eastern Kentucky has, and finish their four-year, get a four-year bachelor's degree. They get some scholarship money with that. Also, the UPike report that Governor Steve Beshear commissioned came out yesterday. It basically said, yes, making UPike a public school would obviously help raise education levels in that area, but the report said they didn't think it would raise it enough and that they would be better off collaborating more and doing the scholarship program like the UPike bill now does. Of course, Speaker Stumbo ripped that proposal, says, you know, these people are from out of state. They don't know what goes on there. I live in that area, and UPike would do wonders. So basically, it's the second verse, same as the first, and they'll probably pass that scholarship bill out this session, and next session, the UPike discussion will probably come right back up.
Where are we on the session's timetable? Are we kind of nearing the end?
Yeah, well, I mean, Monday will be day 50, and that'll be basically 10 or 11 days. So there's a lot of issues we talk about every week, and those issues haven't passed both chambers in the same form. So, you know, they'll have to get the budget out. After they do the budget, if everything goes as planned, they'll probably have 3 or 4 days, just regular days, for them to try to hatch compromises on other bills, either these drug bills, the dropout age, numerous things that we've talked about. And then they'll go home for roughly, you know, 11 days, let the governor see what he vetoes, a line item in the budget or overall bills, and they'll come back for one day on April 12th and try to override those vetoes. So basically, I mean, we're down the last quarter. We're down the stretch they come. So lawmakers are probably going to be scrambling. We'll have a busy next 2 weeks here.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
We now go to South Fulton, Tennessee. We were here last a few years ago when firefighters had watched a home burn to the ground. The owners hadn't paid the required $75 fee for fire service. Now, after a firestorm of national media attention, city leaders have finally made a change. I traveled to South Fulton and found this update. The lot where Paulette and Gene Kranick's mobile home once stood is now full of tree limbs and small, charred pieces of knickknacks. An RV trailer sits where the home's garage once was. The Kranicks, who live just outside the city limits, forgot to pay their 2010 county subscription fee. In September of that year, a fire engulfed their home. City firefighters responded to protect the home of a neighbor who had paid the fee, but they left the Kranicks' home to burn. Inside nearby Pappy's Diner, there are still mixed emotions about that fire. Leon Mann was eating a prime rib sandwich.
And I think anybody that wants fire service ought to pay for it. There's no reason for the people in town to pay for them when they, you know, makes sense to me.
Two tables away, Linda Bates was munching on some onion rings. She says the fire department made a mistake by not extinguishing the blaze at the Kranicks' home.
A neighbor or somebody even offered to pay the fire, and they still wouldn't put it out. And I think that's a travesty.
People in this town are getting tired of talking about what happened, and they may not need to much longer.
Come to order for our regular monthly meeting.
This past week, commissioners in South Fulton, Tennessee, passed a new ordinance that will allow the fire department to respond to all calls within a 5-mile radius of the city. But Commissioner Jeff Val says if a homeowner doesn't pay that $75 annual fire response fee, they'll be charged $3,500 per call.
And that's the thing I think folks may be overlooking. There's a possibility if you live far enough out in the county that you may lose all your possessions by the time the fire department could get there anyway. If you haven't paid now and you request the fire department to come out, you not only have that tragic part of it, but you're going to have to pay $3,500 for it, whereas before, you just didn't have it.
Tight budget times have forced governments across the country to scale back or eliminate services. Still, resident Scott Elligood says this change is a good one.
And I believe that people have to pay for the rural protection because I live in the city, I pay. But at the same time, we just put all the fires out because I think that's an ethical implication. That just because something's legal doesn't make it that ethical.
The new fire protection ordinance in this part of Northwest Tennessee took effect immediately. For WKMS News, I'm Chad Lampe.
When we come back, we begin our occasional series on homelessness in the Four Rivers and hear a new journey story from our region. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton, and you're listening to Front Page Sunday.
And I'm Chad Lampe. For the past 14 years, the nonprofit West Kentucky Workforce Investment Board has worked with the unemployed in our region to provide resources for those looking for new jobs. The WKWIB released a draft of their economic development plan for the next year this week. Shelley Baskin spoke with the board's local director, Sheila Clark, about the WIB's goals and their plan to meet them.
So, Sheila, let's start with the purpose of the Workforce Investment Board. What does the WIB do in our region?
The West Kentucky Workforce Investment Board serves the 17 western counties of Kentucky, and we're one of 10 workforce investment boards that are served the employers and potential employees and individuals seeking employment with opportunities under the Department of Labor's Workforce Investment Act. We also oversee a system of career centers that are multi-partner agencies where we find a variety of employment assistance for either new jobs or better jobs or for those people that may have lost their work and are seeking unemployment or seeking a new job.
And what kind of jobs are opening up in the region for people to take up?
Well, in West Kentucky, over the last 5 years, a little more, we've had several dislocated workers. And when they come into our centers, many of them are looking for a change in occupations because they fear that if they've been in a specific company or area of manufacturing, that downturns in contracts can negatively affect their future. So they try to look at a career goal change for either some of the sectors that they see that are expanding or some of the areas of employment like healthcare that always seem to be there and have additional transition opportunities for them.
Now, the West Kentucky WIB has released a draft for economic development for 2012-2013 for the region. What are the major points of that plan?
Well, the plan addresses economic development growth, but it addresses also the workforce activities that are to be pursued by the workforce board and working with business and industry, regional economic development, education, and other partner agencies that are part of trying to give people better futures by better careers and more opportunities.
So with that plan in place, what would be the goal for the next year?
The West Kentucky Workforce Board works very closely with all of our existing regional economic development efforts, as well as our community college system, Murray State University, and as well as the individual county economic development and chamber efforts. And we feel like that with the partnership that we have with the business community, as well as our local elected officials, that puts us in a wonderful position to try to take the high demands and the sector lift that we're looking at and give greater opportunities for the citizens of Western Kentucky to choose career pathways that will bring them to a living wage and to excel in those areas.
Sheila Clark is the director of the West Kentucky Workforce Investment Board. The 2012-2013 draft is available for public comment until its submission to state officials for approval on April 11th.
In our next story, Murray resident Martin Tracy remembers his grandmother. It's inspired by the Smithsonian Institution exhibition Journey Stories, which concluded its stay at Murray State's Rather West Kentucky Museum earlier this month.
My grandmother was a quintessential American pioneer. In 1891, when she was 17, her family left the comfort of their home and heritage in Marietta, Ohio, to seek their fortune on the American prairie. Her father, Frank D. Booth, was the son of Horatio Booth, a boat pilot on the Ohio River, and the grandson of the first mayor of Marietta, James Mather Booth, an 1804 immigrant from Manchester, England. For over 23 years, Frank Booth was a pilot of the 138-ton J.H. McConnell, a side-wheeler passenger steamboat that ran from Parkersburg, West Virginia, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He was a Civil War veteran, having served as a private with Union troops at Harper's Ferry in the fall of 1862, where he was taken prisoner and paroled. He married Nanny Leach Hill, with whom he had three boys and three girls, including my grandmother, who was born in Marietta in 1874. Her name was spelled R-I-T-A, but pronounced Rita. Frank Booth left his work as a riverboat pilot in 1890. He probably quit because the riverboat traffic was declining due to the emergence of railroads, and because of the attraction of getting 160 acres of virgin prairie land under the Homestead Act of 1862 for only $1.25 an acre. He chose land near Delight, Nebraska, a rural farming community in Custer County, where he started making improvements on a homestead. In 1891, he packed up the family and traveled by train from Marietta to a temporary residence in Des Moines, Iowa, renting a boxcar to carry their furniture and one Jersey heifer. 2 years later, the family moved from Des Moines to Delight. At age 19, Grandmother Rita began teaching in a rural one-room sod schoolhouse with a dirt floor and a wood-burning stove to stave off the brutal Nebraska winters. Families paid $1 a month for each student who would ride horses to school during warm weather and come by sleds in the winter, pulled by horses or dogs. By the time Grandmother Rita was teaching, most of the Native Americans in Nebraska were living on reservations, but there were still roving bands of the Great Sioux Nation. On one occasion, several Indians on horseback rode up to the school, probably just out of curiosity. My grandmother, who was small in stature, but knew how to handle a rifle, stepped outside and told the Indians to leave. They held their ground without speaking. At that, she took aim at a small bird flying high above and fired. As the bird hit the ground, the Indians left. In 1898, when she was 24, Rita married James Albert Tracy in Des Moines. He was 2 years older, but had attended the same high school in Marietta and had come west to Iowa to court her and attend Drake Law School. After their marriage, they moved to Sioux Rapids in northeastern Iowa, where he took up law practice, and where first a daughter, Bonnie, and then a son, James Albert Jr., my father, were born. By 1909, they had moved to Antelope, Nebraska, where Rita gave birth to her third and final child, Helen. 5 years later, they relocated to the small community of Fort Morgan, Colorado, the county seat, located along the Stagecoach and Wagon Overland Trail, which ran from Atchison, Kansas, to Fort Bridger, Wyoming. In Fort Morgan, they raised their children to be independent, self-sufficient Westerners with a love of nature and thirst for adventure in the true American pioneer spirit.
Martin Booth Tracy of Murray is retired from the University of Kentucky and is a part-time consultant on community-based social service programs in Central and Eastern Europe with the International Labor Organization. His remembrances were inspired by the Smithsonian's traveling exhibition Journey Stories, which Murray State's Rather West Kentucky Museum hosted earlier this month.
Paducah's homeless population has seen several changes in the past few months. The long-standing community Tent City was closed in December, and now the residents are finding new places until a permanent shelter is opened in the city. Rose Kristen Preston explores how homelessness in the more rural parts of Kentucky provides unique challenges and opportunities to those who find themselves without a roof over their head.
It's one of those cold gray days in Paducah where the rain doesn't ever seem to stop. For many, that means curling up in their homes. For Carrie Brown, that means her new trailer. It's the first place she's had to call her own since her uncle passed away last June. Carrie worked as a caretaker for her uncle, but when he died, that meant she lost her job. Soon after, she lost her house and was living out of her car.
Like everybody, it's just like one paycheck away from not having a place to live sometimes if you don't have family.
Carrie says she heard about Paducah's Tent City, but was worried about its security. Last September, she was at a soup kitchen where she met two young women who lived in Tent City. Carrie left her broken car behind and moved into the makeshift community. Since then, the city has shut down Tent City because of safety ordinances. Many of the residents were placed into transitional housing. Tent City Missions Coordinator Michelle Thomas has been integral in aiding the homeless of Paducah. She's been working to get people back on their feet for a little over a year. She says it all started when she took her daughters to play golf one day.
And I'm so good that I hit my ball in the middle of the woods one day. And I found an empty camp. And that's really what first piqued my interest is I just knew that was somebody's home. And I asked several people about it. My husband's lived here his whole life. He said, we don't have homeless people in Paducah.
Since then, Michelle has worked with local government, churches, activists, and financiers to try to establish a homeless shelter in Paducah. Paducah is more attractive than many of the surrounding towns for area homeless. Though still considered rural on a national scale, the relatively urban setting of Paducah promises more for them. Even Brown moved from Marshall County to Paducah after losing her home. It has more soup kitchens, food stamp offices, just more resources overall for the homeless. Davy King is the director of specialized housing resources at Kentucky Housing Corporation, which works to distribute finances to programs around the state.
We fund about 50 projects in the balance of state. And when I say balance of state, that's basically 118 counties in Kentucky, which is all of Kentucky except for Louisville, Jefferson, and Lexington, Fayette.
The state is split up like that because of Louisville and Lexington's sizes. King says the challenges for homeless seen in major cities is very different from rural areas.
In rural parts of Kentucky, we sometimes refer to the homeless as sort of the hidden or the invisible homeless.
KHC takes an annual census of homeless individuals in the state based on reported numbers at shelters across the Commonwealth. Last year, Region 1 of KHC's Continuum of Care, which includes the Pennyryle and Purchase areas, totaled at 325 homeless persons, with one of the most populated demographics being young women, single mothers, victims of domestic abuse. Brown, a 30-year-old, says she met many young women during her stay at Tent City.
It's more than what you'd think, too, you know. Because when I was out there, there were 7 girls out there. There was 2 19-year-olds that just didn't have family, didn't have nothing. They ended up back there.
Along with young women, one of the most common features of a homeless Kentuckian is what Michelle Thomas calls being precariously housed. This means couch surfing, living in cars, condemned buildings, barns, or even just living with relatives. She says that educating the public to these important aspects of homelessness is the biggest challenge people like her face. She says a stereotype of a 40-something male with substance abuse problems can cause issues when it comes to asking the public for help.
They have that same old mental picture of somebody in a cardboard box with a brown paper bag. That's not the face of homelessness anymore.
Thomas is now working to fundraise for a Paducah shelter she wants to open. She says she's allocated finances to open it, but operation costs are still unaccounted for. Meanwhile, she and others are working to provide resources to ex-residents of Tent City. Both Thomas and Brown repeatedly mention the supportive network of people helping Paducah's homeless.
I think that if I lived in a big city, I'd probably still be staying in the shelter or whatever. They probably wouldn't have the resources to help you get a job. And
those resources include classes on personal budgeting, parenting skills, and things like how to dress for a job interview. She says she's met people who have only hit a small rough patch and just need a little guidance to get back on their feet. She also met a man named Sammy, who lived for a decade in a makeshift shelter made from railroad ties. He even went through the 09 ice storm in it.
We come across people that don't even have an ID and don't know how to get one.
But mostly, she says the homeless's biggest need is a supportive base on which they can build their way back into a stable situation.
It's like a blink of an eye. You lose your hope. You lose your self-worth. Well, this is just happening to me because I'm just not worth it. You don't see your own value anymore. And then somebody has to intervene or it'll get worse. And that's when you end up with people that have been in a tent in the woods for 10 years.
Carrie Brown now works for a transportation company. She says her few months as a homeless person changed her perspective.
Yeah, I think I've changed as far as being nicer to people. And, you know, I think I've learned a lot. I grew up a lot.
Brown says she plans to become financially stable and to eventually help Thomas and the Tent City Mission in their pursuit of establishing a homeless shelter and resource center in Paducah. For WKMS News, I'm Rose Kristen Presson.
Tent City Missions will continue to fundraise in the coming months. For more information or to learn how you can help, visit WKMS.org. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.